We're transitioning this morning from our Gospel in Real Life series into 5 weeks on peculiar people. And there's some rationale behind it. We find it several places in the scripture, particularly when we get into the King James Version uses this word more than any of the other versions do. But in like Deuteronomy 14, verse 2, we'll see it maybe a little bit later, we see this idea that God has called unto himself his own people. And he says, they will be for me a peculiar people. You know, something that stands out, that stands kind of out of the ordinary from what our culture experiences. Not necessarily cross-cultural, but counter-cultural. And if you've known Kevin and Joetta McLean, they've had some trials recently. And Joetta is willing to come and tell us a little bit of some of the peculiar things that's going on in their life. So come on up, Joetta.
So September 24th started out like an ordinary day. Kevin and the boys were at Big Sandy Camp at Father-Son Camp. They had been there since Friday. Kevin got home from work at about 4 o'clock. I had the bags packed and rushed them into the car and scooted them away. And I had the whole weekend to myself. It was beautiful. And so the 24th was a Sunday. I had gotten up and left the house at 8 o'clock to get to church. And then after church, I stayed here and organized some things, and then I ran to McDonald's and got a salad, and I was going to go home and eat it, and I got home at 1 o'clock, and I went and got the mail, and as I'm walking up to the house, I hear the fire alarms going off, and so I quickened my step, and when I got the door open, I, thinking I was going to smell smoke, but I walked into water, a lot of water. And I could hear, we have two bathrooms on the main level, and from the middle bathroom I could hear, pshhh. So I ran back there with everything in my hands, and the little hose that goes from behind the toilet to the toilet had burst. And there was water spraying across the bathroom, hitting the bathroom wall, and I mean, it was, the water was everywhere. So I turned off the valve for the toilet, and the water stopped. And then apparently that's where craziness comes in just a little bit, because then I ran to the garage to get the shop vac. But our big shop vac, I couldn't get the filter off to get the water sucked up. But we have this little gallon one, which I could get the filter off. So I brought that inside, and I'm full, and I'd go dump it in the bathtub and full. And I did that about 10 times, and then I was like, this is fruitless. There is water everywhere. What is going on? So when I stopped that, I could hear downstairs. So I ran downstairs, and as I got off the bottom step, I stepped into water. And as I'm running down our hallway, there's water coming from the lights, from the smoke alarms, and the smoke alarms are still going off at this point because I don't know how to turn them off. And like the door jams, there's water coming from everywhere. So I got into the mechanic room and I turned off the water to the house. And then at that point, I prayed. Like I scream prayed. What do I do? Where do I start? Help me? And then some logic came in. I'm like, okay, I'm standing in water and there's water coming from the lights. This probably isn't safe. And I need to turn these darn smoke detectors off. How do I get those off? So I flip the breaker to the house. So now I have no power. I'm standing in a dark mechanical room, but the smoke alarms are still going off. Apparently that doesn't do it, just letting you know. So I ran upstairs, and I tried to call Kevin, and of course he didn't answer. Thank you for that. And so I got outside, and my neighbor had just came home. Perfect timing. I ran outside. I'm like, help me. There's water everywhere. What do I do? And she came over very slowly, let me tell you, not as fast as I needed her to. And she's like, oh, my. Okay. So we went downstairs. She's like, what do you need to save? Everything. It's all mine. Go. We need to get everything out. And she's like, well, one step at a time. There's a box. Most everything in the mechanical room was in totes, but there was one box, so we brought that up. And then she goes, well, let's call your insurance. Who's your insurance through? I don't know. Like, You get that paperwork in the mail, you never read it. You know, you just throw it in the pile with the rest of the stuff. But I did know that the house insurance and the car insurance was through the same insurance, so I called the car insurance number, which happened to be the right one. So if you're ever in need, just get your car insurance card. And as I'm on the phone with them, they gave me four directions. Do not touch the toilet. It's now an investigation. They okayed a restoration company. Call a restoration company. Get as much out of the house as you can. And at that point, they okayed us for one night in a hotel. So while I'm on the phone with them, my neighbor gets a hold of Kevin, who's in Deerwood. Is that where you are? And that's still an hour away. Too long. So at least Kevin knows what's going on. And then she starts calling restoration companies, but it's a Sunday. And there was a company that could come out by 5 o'clock. It was ServPro out of St. Cloud. And I'm on the phone, I'm like, perfect, whoever can get out here, just send them. So we have them coming at 5. I get off the phone with the insurance company, I'm bawling by this point. And then I made one call to Pete Ring. And I just said, there's water everywhere. I got home from church. Kevin's not home. I need help. And he just said, yep, I will get people there. Don't worry. And within an hour, there were 20 people in our house they emptied our house in about an hour and a half, 2 hours. Like, everything from our house got out. You can show pictures if you want. So apparently, when I clean a room, I take a picture because it doesn't happen a lot. So this was our dining room, nice and clean. Next, this is our dining room now. Everything, floors are ripped out, stove is out, our island is out. You can go to the next picture. This was our clean living room, nice place to sit and relax. Next, now it's not. So we felt so much love from the church at that point that it was amazing. And I told Kevin, if we ever need to skip town, we can do it in less than 2 hours. But I was reassured that if I ever did skip town, we wouldn't get that kind of support to help empty out the house. Then ServPro came. Well, Kevin got home with the boys. Everyone was there. And then ServPro got there at 5. And the guy's walking around the house, and Brody still had his I Love My Church shirt on. And he goes, hey, our church does that. Where do you go to church? And Brody turned around, and Alliance Church? My whole crew is from an Alliance Church from Big Lake. And that was the first time where it made me stop. And I'm like, oh, God has a sick sense of humor. He really does. And I'm like, I know you're here with me. I know you're walking through this with us. So that was number one. They've been so good to work with. They've been an awesome team that helped rip apart our house. Like, truly, they ripped apart our house. You can go to the next slide. This was our living room downstairs. That was a nice place. Next, it's not a nice place anymore. They had to rip out all the ceilings. We had insulation between the floors for sound, and So this is our house right now. So the next morning, I talked to the insurance company, and it was the real person instead of just the emergency person. And we learned that apparently we had taken out additional living expense coverage when we took out our insurance, which was amazing because we get to stay in the hotel until our house is livable again, and they pay for our food. So apparently when I took out the insurance, Kevin was not with me because he would have said, we don't need that. But we did need that. And currently, today marks 28 days in the hotel, which this is an adventure, isn't it, guys? We are doing great, though. We've spent more family time together. And another really cool thing is, about a week after we had been in the hotel, we learned that there was another family that had water damage in the hotel as well, and they had kids. And one Wednesday after school, we were doing our walk back in after school with our backpacks back into the hotel, and another family was walking in, and And I said, oh, you're that other family, aren't you? And she goes, oh, you're that other family, aren't you? And I said, yep. And so we started talking, and not only had their house flooded, they weren't able to get a restoration company in for like 2 or 3 days. So they're dealing with mold. His car was broken into during the week at the hotel, so kicked him while they're down. And with the rental car that they were given, he got in a car accident. So, I mean, this family is down as far as you can probably, I mean, I thought we were doing bad. We're fine. We're doing great. But it was a Wednesday, and I said, you know what? It sounds like you guys have a lot going on. And they had a fourth grader. And I said, we're going to go to Awana tonight. Do you want to come with us? And she's like, yeah, I'll get out of here. I'll go with. So for the last 2 weeks, she's been coming to Awana. And last Wednesday, on our way back to the hotel, we always do our what'd you learn tonight? And her response was, tonight I learned that God is everywhere, just like Santa Claus. You know what? But even though that was her response, it made me sing. It made my heart sing that even though they're going through a terrible experience just like us, she's learning about Jesus, and she's learning about God. And if this is what it took. And then later that night, the mom and I were texting back and forth, and she was saying, thank you for taking her. She had a blast. You know, hopefully we can do it next week. And one of the responses she had given was, I feel like we met for a bigger reason. Yes. Yes, we did. So that is our adventure that we are currently on. And there has been downs, but there has also been many, many ups. And that's what we're going to keep looking for. Tuesday, just as an update, we meet with the contractor to hopefully sign contracts to start getting our house back together, because nothing has, besides drying out, our house has had nothing go on yet. So we're at 28 days now. Hopefully we sign contracts this week so we can start work. And Thanksgiving, is that? I'm hoping we're back home by Thanksgiving. We'll see. So that's where we're at.
Thank you, Joetta. It's, you know, we serve a God who's called us to himself, and then he puts us in these positions where we can't help but, in a sense, if we're going to follow him, stand out as peculiar. You know, and there you have a peculiar person, even without the circumstances, in Joetta, thrown into a situation with circumstances, and yet you see how God takes that and says, "This, look at my people. Look how peculiar they are in your, you know, look how countercultural they are. Look how they love people despite the circumstances that are around them." And that's what we're called to. And what we're going to find here today, so we're going to go through, and I got a lot to go through, and I'm going to do it pretty efficiently, so don't panic here. We're going to go through 1 Samuel chapter 17. It's the story of David and Goliath. And so I'm going to skip past that verse. We've already looked at that. But I want to give you a little bit of a background as to where we're at and how we're getting there. Last week, we talked about this idea of perspective. We talked about how in the Gospel of John, we're taking a break from that for a few weeks as we look towards getting ready for our missions conference, which is themed Peculiar People. We just saw it. We talked about it briefly with Deuteronomy 14:2, where God chooses for himself this chosen people, and they will be for me this peculiar people that's countercultural to the rest of the world. They stand out in such a way, and it's a beautiful picture. Some of the other translations you'll see, they're my special people. They're my chosen people, as opposed to peculiar. But what we find here, so we're in 1 Samuel 17 today, and we're going to see David, this character who's also shows himself in a very peculiar way, like what we talked about last week. He's got a perspective that's kind of beyond where everyone else's perspective was. Last week, we talked about this idea of perspective. We talked about how Mary and Martha were suffering and hurting with sorrow, and that's a reasonable perspective to have when you lose a brother. That made sense. We talked about how the disciples had this perspective about when Jesus says, we're going to go back to Judea. Well, there was danger in Judea. They were wanted to kill Jesus, and if they're going back with them, the danger is going to fall on themselves as well. So their perspective is, if we go to Judea, we will die with Jesus. That's a reasonable perspective. perspective to have under their circumstances. It made sense. And yet what Jesus had was this greater perspective that said, okay, here's the thing, guys. I know you're hurting. I know you're sorrow. I know you're fearful. But through those things, through that reality, I am going to do something that is going to be way bigger because I care about your sorrow. I care about your hurt. I care about your fear, but I care about something way more than that. And that is the fact that I care about your belief in me. And that's what he laid out last week. We talked about how he took this glory of God that is always there and he revealed it. He opened himself up to it. And we're going to see that continue when we get into the Gospel of John again. But for today, in 1 Samuel chapter 17, what we find is we have a man by the name of Saul who is king. He was the first king of Israel. Before Saul, they relied on prophets and judges. And God was, in a sense, their king. And he would speak through these prophets, he would speak through these judges, and they would do the interacting with the people like Moses was, in a sense. But up until this point, that's all that they had had. Well, Israel, they've gone into this land of Canaan, and they're looking around, and they see all these other nations, and they say, well, you know, we want a king like these other nations. And God recognizes they are rejecting me as their king, and they want another king. And Samuel says, what is wrong with you people? Samuel was the prophet at this time. I know I'm going really quick, okay? So just hang tight. If you need a seatbelt, go ahead and use it. So Samuel, who was the prophet at this time, is telling these people, you guys, you're rejecting God as your king. And God finally says, you know, Samuel, give them what they want, right? They want an earthly king. We're going to give them an earthly king, all right? I don't know what my first verse is. Here it is. And notice, this is Saul. Saul's going to be the first king. So Samuel goes up to Saul and says, Saul, guess what? You're going to be the next king of Israel. And this is Saul's response. This is a very character-filled response from Saul. He says, but am I not a Benjaminite? Okay, Benjamin, if you remember Benjamin, he was the youngest son of Jacob, all right, the least in a sense. Am I not a Benjaminite from the smallest of the tribe of Israel, and is not my clan the least of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? Why would I be selected? And so you see this humility with Saul that exists right from the beginning. It's a beautiful picture of this humility of Saul, but it doesn't last. Saul, somewhere along the lines, finds this arrogance and this confidence, and it's a self-confidence, and it's not a confidence in what God has for him at all. And what we end up finding is Saul then, as the king, he goes up against and he starts fighting some of these other nations as a king, and everyone's looking like, wow, Saul is a great king, he's a great leader. They fight the Philistines at one point. And Saul, as their king, conquers the Philistines at this point. And the Philistines will make the statements like, Saul was like became like a stench to their nostrils. In other words, the Philistines hated Israel, and even more so, they hated Saul. Because he was like this punisher that was coming down on the Philistines, and so they didn't like him at all. And at one point, what happens is, there's Saul, he's got 2,000 men, his son Jonathan is commanding 1,000 men, they got 3,000 guys total. Well, unfortunately for them, the Philistines have gathered 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, that doubles their number right there, and it says that they had as many soldiers as the sands on the seashore. And so they get just way outnumbered. And Saul finds himself on the mountain of Gilgal, and he's being surrounded by Philistines. Samuel has said, you wait for me on that mountain. I'm going to come up there, and I'm going to give the burnt offering, the sacrifice, and then God is going to take control, and he's going to lay it down on the Philistines, even if you only have 3,000 men. But Saul, watch what happens here. So Saul remained on Gilgal, waiting for Samuel, and all the troops with him were quaking with fear. So his troops are afraid. Right? You're way outnumbered. He waited 7 days, the time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and Saul's men began to scatter. Okay, Samuel hasn't shown up. Now all of a sudden, Saul's got 3,000 men, and he's starting to get less men because they're starting to flee. They're starting to scatter because they recognize perspective. This is a bad situation. We will not live through it. So he said, bring me the burnt offering. This is Saul saying, bring me the burnt offering. And the fellowship offering, and Saul offered up these burnt offerings. Just as he finished making the offering, Samuel arrived, and Saul went out to greet him. And notice what Samuel says, what have you done? Saul replied, when I saw that the men were scattering, okay, remember he had this humility, he was a God-fearing king before this point. The men were scattering. I was afraid, in a sense, for my life. I lost my perspective, if you will. And totally, it's reliant on myself. I had to take matters into my own hand. They were scattering. And you did not come at the set time, and so the Philistines were assembling at Michmash. I thought, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the Lord's favor, so I've got to at least do this. But he brings it up on himself. He recognizes that it's me that's going to do this work, that's going to bring out victory. So I felt compelled to offer up the burnt offering. And notice what Samuel says, you have done a foolish thing. You have not kept the command the Lord God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command. And that person is David. And this happened just two chapters before we get into what happens here with David. So this young man, if you don't know the story of David when he was anointed, what happens is Samuel, after this incident, God says, all right, Samuel, you need to go to the house of Jesse. That's where you're going to find the next king. The first one out is Eliab. That's David's oldest brother. And he comes out and he looks all the part of the king. And Samuel's like, surely this is the guy that's going to be the king. And God says, nope. And then seven more brothers, nope, 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 nope. And then he goes back to Jesse. He says, you must have another son because none of these guys are going to be the next king. And Jesse says, I got one more, but he's like the youngest. He's out in the field. He's a shepherd. You know, he's like 12. You know, and so we'll bring him out. And sure enough, when David comes out, God says to Samuel, you know, man looks on the outward appearance. As you look on Eliab, that kingly person, well, I'm looking at the heart. I'm looking for something different. I'm looking for something peculiar. And in this young boy, I see something peculiar. Anoint him. And so then this David, this peculiar boy, is going to do some amazing things here this morning. How am I doing? Wow, I got 6 minutes. I'm going to nail it. We haven't even touched chapter 17 yet. And I know for a fact there's people waiting for me to be done. Okay. I know, just as a side note, just, you know, I know who read my email from yesterday and who didn't. Because if you read my email yesterday, you came up to me and said, oh, are you okay? If you didn't read my email, you came up to me and said, what happened to your face? So just clear the air on that. Because everyone was like, no one's making eye contact with me for the last 2 days. I said, you know, what's wrong with your face? What are you talking about? Anyway, I'll give you a little picture real briefly here. This is the kingdom that Saul had. Down here, there's Jerusalem. This region right there where Philistia kind of connects with the kingdom of Saul. This is where this event that we're going to talk about is going to be taking place. I'm zooming in here. There's Jerusalem. There's Bethlehem. Right there, this valley of Elah is the valley that we're talking about. And here's a real picture of it. And so what we're going to find here this morning is we have, this is where Saul's camp is. And here we have the Philistine camp. And then there's this valley in between. And there's a creek down on the bottom of it. And that's going to be important to know as we get into the scriptures this morning. So, 1 Samuel 17. Here we go. Verses 1 through 3. So now the Philistines had gathered. Here they are. They've gathered on the side of the hill. Their forces for war are assembled, and they're ready to attack. Saul, verse 2, and the Israelites assembled. I'm also, just so you know, I'm not going to read the whole chapter. So I'll try, if you have your Bibles, you'll be able to follow along, but I'm going to tell you what verse I'm on. So suddenly I'll maybe go from one, and I'll skip two verses. I have them highlighted here. If you need a Bible, Mike can get you one, or Steve can get you one. Just slip your hand up. I won't be looking. So it says, verse 2, it says, Saul and the Israelites assembled at their camp in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites occupied another hill. Now, this is super, super cool here. A champion named Goliath, okay, we've heard about the story of David and Goliath. All right, this champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. He was over 9 feet tall. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he wore a coat of scale armor and a scale of armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. On his legs, he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. 600 shekels would be about 15 pounds. An Olympic shot put weighs about 16 pounds. You know, so now you imagine this great big 9 foot man. The Olympic world record for shot put is less than 74 feet for a 16 pound shot put. Now you imagine this Goliath. I'm pretty sure he'd set the world record being able to throw a javelin, okay, or a spear, if you will, a 15 pound headed spear. I mean, this is a mammoth of a man. You know, and some people argue, well, he wasn't really that big. I think he was that big, and perhaps even a little bit bigger. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. Okay, so he's just a huge, huge man. So Goliath stood and he shouted to the ranks of Israel, why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine and you are the servants of Saul? He doesn't even call them Israelites. You are the servants of that stench that we call Saul. And we don't like you one bit. You're very nasty and mean, and we would like to just destroy you. So choose a man amongst yourselves and have him come down to me. Okay, we got to touch on a couple things as we go. First of all, this is not the first giant that we have seen in the scriptures. We oftentimes look at, okay, Goliath was huge. He was a giant. Well, there's other spots in the scriptures that talk about this idea of giants. It says, but then men, if you remember the spies, remember they went into Canaan. This is when they're going through the wilderness. They've just fled Egypt. They come at the edge of Canaan, and they send in these 12 spies. Go check out the land. Well, the spies come back, and this is 10 of them have this reply. Caleb and Joshua were the only ones that said, yes, we can take them because they had the right perspective. Well, this is the response of the 10, but the men who had gone up with them said, we can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are. And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land that they had explored. They said, the land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim. There, the descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. We seem like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we look the same to them. What's also interesting, Moses... Catch this. Moses fought a giant. Did you realize that? We oftentimes look at David fights Goliath, a giant, but did you realize that Moses also fought a giant? This is wonderful. Look at this. So next, this is Moses here. Next, we turned and went up along the road toward Bashan. And Og, remember that was going to be the name of Paige and Chris's first son. They decided against that and went with Roy instead. I know, I was leaning still towards Og. But Og is a fascinating name. It's got two letters, very easy to spell. And Og, king of Bashan, with his whole army, marched out to meet us in battle. The Lord said to me, do not be afraid of him. Obviously, okay, you could look at that. Okay, he's just afraid because it's going into battle. But there's something really wonderful about this. Stay with me. So do not be afraid of him, for I have delivered him into your hands along with his whole army and his land. Do to him what you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon. So the Lord our God also gave into our hands Og, king of Bashan, and his army. We struck them down, leaving no survivors. Look at this. Verse 11. Og, king of Bashan, was the last of the Rephaites. His bed was decorated. Now, the bed could be looked at. They're either referring to the bed that he slept in, but most scholars actually believe it's probably his sarcophagus. In other words, his coffin, if you will. Okay? So his bed was decorated with iron and was more than 9 cubits long and 4 cubits wide, and it's still there to be seen. This is the comparison based on that bed size. This is what you'd have for David. Here's Goliath. Here's Og. It's remarkable, isn't it? Moses went up against it, and there's like no mention that Og was like this huge, huge guy. In fact, this is actually believed to be a little bit short of what he actually could be, because they believe that his sarcophagus would have been measured in his own cubits. And it's obviously a cubit is from your elbow to your fingertip. And so the taller you are, the larger your cubit. Okay? Your Rubik's cubit. Okay. But now, so Saul here is calling for a champion. Goliath is calling for a champion. He's down there. He's saying, all right, give to me your best fighter. Give to me the one who is your champion that can defeat me. There's only one choice in Israel, and it's this guy, Saul, because look at the description of Saul. It says, Kish had a son named Saul. As handsome a young man as he could be, found anywhere in Israel, and he was a head taller than anyone else. That's Saul. He's a head taller than anyone else in all of Israel. If there's anyone that should be going down to fight, it should be Saul. Okay? When Samuel caught sight of Saul, the Lord said to him, this is the man I spoke to. He will govern my people. He's also been chosen by God. We see this description still further in chapter 10, and it says in verse 23, they ran and brought him out, and as he stood among the people, this is Saul, he was a head taller than any of the others. Samuel said to all the people, do you see the man the Lord has chosen? There is none like him among all of the people. And the people shouted, long live the king. That should be Israel's champion. But instead, here's Saul, and he is afraid, and his army follows suit. And they're all desperately afraid of this man, Goliath. Picking it up, we're going to start at verse 12. So now David, who was a son of Jesse. Okay, Jesse was old and advanced in years. David was the youngest of the boys. He has three brothers who are fighting for Saul's army. And Jesse basically says to David, he says, David, I want you to take some supplies to your brothers. So he takes these supplies to his brothers, and he arrives there, and this is what it says after he arrives here. It says, early in the morning when David had left, David left his things with the keeper, and he goes to fight the battle, or goes to find the battle lines, because all of Israel and all of the Philistines have gathered for battle. And then, verse 23, as he was talking with his brothers, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance, and David heard it. When the Israelites saw the man, they all ran from him in great fear. Because Saul was afraid of him, the Israelites followed suit, and they likewise were afraid of him. Verse 26, David asked, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Notice his brashness. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine? In other words, who is this person who is not set apart for God's purposes? That's really what he's getting at here. Who is this guy that we should be afraid of him? That he should be able to defy the armies of the living God. Verse 28, when Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him, he speaks against David and says, you're only here, you know, you're selfish to go and watch the battle. David's response is, goes to Saul and he says, let no one lose heart. Catch this. Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. I will go. Here's Saul, who stands a head taller than anyone else in the army, has virtually, and we don't know his age, but David was probably not over 12 years old. You know, he might have been up to 16, but in either case, you have this guy who is this giant of a man in Israel, and you have this boy come up to him and says, don't lose heart. I'll go fight the big guy. I can take him, you know? And you got to look at, okay, so Saul is already that much taller. Saul and David, I mean, Saul should be able to just wreck David. And he's going up and says, I'm not afraid of anyone that's 9 feet tall. You send me, I'll take him, okay? So he says, no one lose heart, I'll go fight him. And Saul replied, you're not able to go, you're just a boy. 34, I love this. David says, you know, I can do it. Because your servant has been keeping my father's sheep. And when I have kept my father's sheep, when a lion or a bear had carried off any one of the sheep, I went after it. You know, he didn't flee from the danger. He went after it. I struck it and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of the Philistines. And catch what Saul says next. Okay, go. Could you imagine you're the tallest man in all of Israel and you have a 12-year-old boy coming up to you and saying, I'll go fight the big guy. And what would you do? Any reasonable-minded adult who is that kind of size would say, I can't let you go do that, son. You know what I'm saying? But what does Saul say? Okay, better you than me. In a nutshell, that's really what he's saying, okay? Better you go than me go because I'm afraid of this man. Go to your own death. Mind-blowing. So then, maybe as an act of goodwill, he takes David and starts putting his armor on him, which doesn't fit. So David sheds the armor. And listen to this, verse 40. So David, he took his staff in his hand. He chose 5 small stones from that stream that we saw up there. He put them in a pouch of his shepherd bag. And with a sling in his hand, he approached the Philistine. David is going in totally unarmed. I know we say he's got a sling and he's got a staff. He's going in totally as a shepherd would to care for his sheep. He's got no sword. He's got no army. He's virtually going in unarmed. And not only is he going in unarmed, he's a 12-year-old boy against a giant of a man. There is nothing here that would point to David having the advantage. You know, we talk about these David and Goliath moments all the time, and I get that, but there's a bigger factor, and David recognizes this. David would have known Moses' history. David would have known the history of the Israelites. He would have known that when Moses went up against these people, it wasn't Moses' great strategic warfare. It wasn't Moses' weaponry that was winning the battle. It was something else. It was something different, and it was God that went with him, and David gets the perspective. And he's saying, I'll go. In fact, I'll go unarmed. I'll bring my shepherd stuff. I got my staff. I got my sling, I got my little bag of rocks, and he goes. It gets better. So, there he goes. Meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bearer in front of him kept coming closer to David. So as David's coming down, here goes Goliath. He looks at David and saw he was only a boy, ruddy and handsome. He despised him because he was handsome. He's probably ugly and had a scar on his face, you know. He said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? His staff. And the Philistine cursed David. Come here, he said, and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. And David said to the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear. No, you come to me with weapons. Okay, I get that. You come to me with weapons. But I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. I mean, this is a 12-year-old boy saying, guess what? Let me tell you what's going to happen here. Just to be clear, Goliath, you have the sword. You have the sword. In other words, what I'm saying is, I'm going to disarm you with your sword. I'm going to use your sword. I didn't bring one. I'm going to use your sword, and I'm going to cut off your head with your sword. I know, right? I told you it's going to get better. Listen to this, though. Today, contrast this. He said, Goliath had said, I will give your flesh to the birds. This is what David says. Today, I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds. I mean, you see the step up? You know, Goliath is saying, I will give you, that little boy, I will give your flesh to the birds to eat. And David says, not only am I going to cut off your head, I'm going to give the whole Philistine army to the birds to eat. And I don't have a sword. And then the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or by spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. And then it says David ran quickly toward the battle. He didn't shy away from it. He's got a tough thing facing him. You know, one thing that John Ortberg writes in his book, Soul Keeping, is that God never gives, in the Bible, never gives anyone something easy to do. And this is not easy for David. I'm convinced of that. David sure makes it look easy, but I don't see this as being easy. And David runs to face what it is laying out before him. Reaching into his bag, he takes out a stone. He slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank deep into the forehead, and he fell face down. The battle is over before it even started. And without a sword in his hand, David ran and stood over him. He took hold of the Philistine's sword and drew it from the scabbard, and then he killed him. He cut off his head with the sword, just like he had said. And when the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and they ran. And the army of Israel, who was rallied behind the confidence that David had, rose up and pursued the Philistines and attacked them. You know, and David wasn't the king. He wasn't the leader. You know, and that had to be very humbling for Saul, I think, in this point. But there's a perspective, and I want you to grasp it, because you, just like we talked about last week, David's coming with a perspective, Saul's got a perspective, and the Israelites have a perspective. And you could throw in the Philistines and Goliath in there too. But I want you to grasp this. Saul's perspective, somewhere along the lines, he lost sight of who was really fighting the battle, and he thought it was him. He got into this, like, I can't do this, I have to do this, this mentality where in order for anything successful to happen, I have to do it. I recognize that. That's what Saul's mentality was. That was his perspective. He was afraid then when he saw this challenge that he felt like he couldn't face. When Goliath stands before him calling for a champion, there's really only one option for Israel, and that option is afraid and is unwilling to go because he's lost perspective. He's saying, I can't beat this guy. And all of Israel sees their champion says, the king can't beat this guy. We're toast. And so likewise, their perspective is, if the king can't beat him, we can't beat him. And bringing a 12-year-old boy, I got him. His perspective isn't, and David's confidence is not in himself. He knows that firsthand. There's no way if I'm fighting a bear or a lion, my confidence is in me. If I'm spared from a bear or a lion, it is only because God did something amazing. God did something incredible in the conflict with a bear or a lion. So I think David knew first and foremost where that was coming from and was able to run then to this battle. Goliath is nothing compared to the God that I serve and what he can do. But look at this. Remember we had this last week, Colossians 3. And I see this perspective of Saul. And so he says, if you're serious about living this new resurrection life with Christ, act like it. Pursue the things which Christ presides. Don't shuffle along. And I see Saul, here he is. He's found his strength only in himself, and he sees himself as weak, and he's afraid. And all he's doing is looking down at his feet as he's shuffling along, saying, I can't do this. I can't do this. And for 40 days, it said that they were afraid of this Goliath. So don't shuffle along, eyes to the ground, absorbed in the things right in front of you. Look up. And this is where David comes on the scene. And David helps the whole nation of Israel get your eyes off of yourselves, get your eyes off of the ground in front of you. Look up and be alert to what's going on around you. That's where the action is. See things from God's perspective. And that's exactly what David did. It's not just a repeat of last week, because I think what we find here, and more specifically, when we look at this idea of perspective, I think we are challenged and we have to look at this idea. Our lives are filled with challenge. And sometimes we look at, okay, I can handle this. But somewhere along the lines, there's going to be something that comes along that's like, I'm lost. I can't handle this anymore. And when that's the case, what are we going to do? How are we going to respond? Are we just going to flee away from that challenge, saying, I'm done, I can't do it? Or are we going to be like David and say, I'm going to run to the battle. I don't know what's going to happen, but God's got this. He's going to do something. He's going to do something greater than I could ever do on my own. And I think that we saw that with the testimony from Kevin and Joetta. Did they ask for it? No. Was this something they could handle? Probably not. You know, are they still handling it? Not really, but God is. You know, even in the midst of bringing in that other crew from that other Lions Church, there was this family piece that's like, man, God, you have me even now in the midst of that. And God's got you even in the midst of that. Whatever you're facing, God's got you in the midst of that. Trust him in that way. And don't be afraid to run to that battle. Don't be afraid to run into what you're going. It's like, it's okay to say, I can't handle this, God. Help me to trust that you can. Because that's a reality, okay? You know, sometimes we say, well, I just trust God. And really inside, we're just like, I am so afraid and I can't tell anyone that I'm afraid. It's okay to say, I'm afraid, but God, you are bigger than it. Take away my fear. Help me to see things from your perspective.